Well, good morning. It's 8:06 on this Friday. It's January 31st. In with a weather report from the ABC4 Meteorology Center, we've got Cedric Hayes. Cedric, good morning. How's it looking out there?
Good morning. Yes, I'll tell you what. Well, it's a frigid start out there this morning with temperatures in the single digits and teens across most of the Wasatch Back. In fact, we've got some areas in the single digits, some areas in the teens. But these numbers are a few degrees warmer than where they have been most of this week to start off the day. But that doesn't mean it's going to be very warm. We will climb likely around 40 to 43 degrees this afternoon. I think we'll probably hold right around 40 degrees at Park City, but in the Heber Valley, we may climb between 43 to 44 degrees as we go into this afternoon. Now, one thing you will notice, of course, we'll see clouds that will become on the increase as we go into the afternoon and evening hours. And by late this evening into tonight, we're going to introduce some precipitation. We've got an atmospheric river that's going to be plowing into the Beehive State, especially the northern half of the Beehive State as we go throughout this weekend. And that's going to mean all kinds of weather for us. So as we go into your Saturday, we're going to kick off our Saturday with the potential of some heavy mountain snow that's going to be out there for us. We're talking about multiple inches of snow could come down before we see things actually warming up during the day. But we do have a winter weather advisory that's going to be in effect tonight through Saturday afternoon. We're looking at probably about 2 to 5 inches of snow in the Park City area, with somewhere around 1 to 3 inches in the Heber Valley. But either way, it's going to be a heavy, wet snow that's going to be coming down. And as we go into the afternoon hours tomorrow, we'll finally start to see those temperatures warming up. But for most of our Saturday, expect some wintry conditions across the area. Now, by Saturday night, those temperatures warm actually above freezing, even in Park City. So I think what we'll mainly be seeing is just a cold rain event taking place. And as we go throughout the day on Sunday, any snow will quickly change over to a cold rain across the area, but we could be seeing quite a bit of rain. And total liquid precipitation amounts could be in that 1 to 2 inch range as we go into the afternoon hours. Now, as we go into the forecast here for the rest of the week, heading into next week, we're looking at those clouds on the increase. We're looking at those overnight lows in the 30s, highs in the mid to upper 40s. And we'll stay that way as we go throughout most of next week. There is another chance of some mountain snow returning by the time we get towards the middle and latter half of next week. But of course, all eyes will be on the heavy snow event that's possible late tonight into tomorrow. Again, we're looking at about 1 to 3 inches in the Heber Valley, but in Park City, we could be talking about anywhere from 2 to 5 inches of snow. That winter weather advisory, again, goes into effect around 8 o'clock this evening and will continue through Saturday afternoon. So basically, that just means slow it down and use caution if you're going to be traveling through the mountain roads, and understand that we will have some winter driving conditions as we go throughout your Saturday before things improve a little bit heading into Sunday. But yeah, big change heading our way. We go from a lot of sunshine to some wintry weather building in as we go into the next 24 hours.
Awesome. Well, we will keep an eye out for that snow. Thank you so much. That's ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Hayes. And checking in on the backcountry conditions, we have got the from Utah Avalanche Center, Greg. Greg, what's it looking like out there?
Yeah, good morning. So you just heard the weather forecast. We have some messy weather headed our way. We've been enjoying, and I say that word carefully, we've been enjoying relatively low avalanche danger this week. But we're going to be seeing an increasing danger coming this weekend. As a matter of fact, yesterday we had a low danger, and we've bumped it back up to moderate today because we've been seeing an increase in winds, particularly at the upper elevations overnight and into today. So I think we're going to be finding some fresh wind drifts on upper elevation slopes. These are going to be on the shady slopes, so slopes facing northwest through north and east, even some southeast. So moderate danger, rising to moderate danger this afternoon as the winds increase. But the big change is really this coming weekend. So you just heard the weather forecast. We're expecting heavy snow overnight into Saturday. It's going to be a messy storm. It's going to start out a little colder, but the temperature is going to be warming. It's going to be raining to Park City. Matter of fact, we're probably going to be seeing rain snow lines as high as 8,000 or 8,500 feet. And above the rain snow line is going to be this heavy, wet snow. So with that in mind, we've actually issued an avalanche watch. Now, a watch is not a warning. Watch just is saying that we're expecting a rising avalanche danger this weekend. I think if the weather forecast materializes, we'll likely be at a warning level Saturday or Sunday, where the danger could rise to considerable or even high. So human-triggered and natural avalanches could be possible by this weekend. So yeah, for today, moderate danger upper elevations, and just, you know, telling people to give a heads up that we're expecting definitely an increase in avalanche conditions over this weekend. So as always, please visit UtahAvalancheCenter.org for the latest.
Thank you so much. That's Greg from the Utah Avalanche Center. Taking a quick look at the traffic, it looks like the usual suspects in terms of slowdowns. There's some delays on the 80 ramp over by Kimball Junction as you head into town. And again, some delays as you approach Canyons Village going down 224. Some significant slowdowns over on 248 headed westbound toward Park City over from Quinns Junction. Across the rest of the region, I'm not seeing much in terms of traffic or other slowdowns. We will be back with some more local news, but first, a couple of messages from our underwriters. This is the Local News Hour. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Roger Goldman on this Friday morning. Coming up, we've got some good interviews. We've got the Park City Community Foundation's E.E. Sue. She's in to discuss how the Sundance Film Festival brings communities together. She'll share a little bit about some of the programming that's been going on around town, apart from the films this week. Then we've got the National Ability Center Chief Programming and Education Officer, Tracy Meyer, on the 37th Annual Huntsman Cup. That's making history as the first U.S. race to include skiers with intellectual disabilities. And then we've got Ron Jackenthal with the Live Like Sam Foundation. He'll share more about the Thrive program, which is about mental health for teens and middle schoolers. Then we've got KPCW's own Sarah Irvin and John Burdick. They'll share more about the Community Campfire. That's a new Friday show that's debuting next week. That is all coming up right here on the Local News Hour. Well, this streaming giant Netflix has made its first purchase of the 2025 Sundance Film Festival. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Netflix has bought the drama Train Dream, starring Joel Edgerton, Felicity Jones, and William H. Macy, according to Variety. Deadline reported the purchase was over $10 million. The film is an adaptation of Dennis Johnson's 2011 novella of the same name. The story follows a day laborer building America's railroads at the start of the 20th century as he experiences love, defeat, and a world transforming before his eyes. The film has been well received. Train Dreams has a 92% fresh score with critics on Rotten Tomatoes. The movie, which premiered in Salt Lake City Saturday night, was directed by Clint Bentley, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Greg Quidar. The two recently collaborated on Sing Sing, which received an Academy Award nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay. Netflix has made big purchases at Sundance in recent years. In 2022, the company purchased the erotic thriller Fair Play for $20 million. Last year, Netflix bought It's What's Inside for $17 million. The purchase of Train Dreams is the second reported deal at Sundance 2025. The company Neon bought the horror film Together for $15 million. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And joining me in studio, we've got E.E. Sue from the Park City Community Foundation. E.E., I understand you have been going around to a lot of the programming at Sundance this year while the festival's been in town. And that includes the Sunrise House, which I guess is a pretty new AAPI space. Could you tell me a little bit about what that house has been up to this festival?
Yeah, of course. First of all, thank you so much for having me here this morning. You know, I've been reflecting a little bit about Sundance, and I moved here 8 years ago, and I've kind of witnessed what's been happening with Sundance. And originally it was like, oh, this is a film festival. We're going to go and we're going to see all these incredible stories from independent filmmakers. And there's a whole element around the commercial brokering of films that's happening. But as I've been digging a little bit deeper with Sundance, what I've really realized is that it's a community builder. It's a community of filmmakers and creatives and talent that come together every year. And there's really been a focus in the stories that are untold and unrepresented. Enter the Sunrise House. Sunrise House is, it's in its third, well, we just had the third year. I'm not going to say we, but the Sunrise House just had their third year of programming here on Main Street. And that house has really been to feature the work from Pan, Asia American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander filmmaking. So what I think is really cool about Sundance is there's this whole story of programming and community building that happens beyond the official Sundance programming. And that was really, you know, the impetus of kind of having me here is to talk about like what that brings to Sundance and also what that brings to our community. So the Sunrise House, again, in its third year, and I was lucky enough to get an invitation. This is my second year attending. It's an organization that's was started by the actor Daniel Dae Kim, his organization 3AD, Gold House, and the Asian American Foundation. And again, featuring creatives to come together and create this community and to really... like incubate and accelerate filmmaking and the stories of groups that are traditionally unrepresented. You know, I grew up, you know, with stereotypes around Asian American in entertainment, like, I don't know, Long Duk Dong from 16 Candles, you know. I never had somebody that I could see on television that really showed, like, really could display like the true stories of the Asian American experience. And I think that's true for so many underrepresented groups. So the Sunrise House was here, 2 days of incredible programming from some very prominent directors, actors, filmmakers. Sean Wong, who made Dee Dee last year, he was on a panel with the director from King Richard, talking about filmmaking and how Sundance and Sundance Labs in its ability to incubate creative storytelling has really been a force to elevate these stories and develop these stories.
That sounds really cool. And some of the films you mentioned, I remember having seen them and still thinking about them a year later. So clearly they really do make an impact. What were the conversations like as you were in that space?
Well, I think, you know, one of the big takeaways from that conversation was that, I guess, you know, finally we're seeing more of these stories surface and surface in mainstream media. I think Netflix and some of the other streaming services provides a platform for this. But it was also a story about how this has been really hard and it's been many decades in the making. There was one director, Justin Lin, you know, I attended one panel and he started off in independent filmmaking. He had a film, but then he went on to make a bunch of commercial films. He was actually the director of many of the Fast and Furious films, and he has now come back to independent movie making. And I think, you know, what I'm hearing from these directors and these actors is that independent filmmaking is really dear to their heart because they can actually develop the stories that they want to tell. Again, a narrative that is... you know, very authentic to that experience. And also isn't necessarily, you know, I think one of the things is ultimately we want to get to a place where it's not necessarily an Asian American story or a Latinx story, but it is, you know, a story of being human and, you know, and that we all belong in this community.
Yeah, and I mean, that being said, the Sunrise House isn't the only multicultural space at Sundance. Could you speak a little bit to what some of the other spaces are and why it's so important to have them?
Well, first of all, I'm not an expert. Yeah. I'm just a casual observer, I guess an engaged observer in all of this. But there are a lot of houses, you know, that serve to convene filmmakers and creatives in different spaces. So I know the Latinx has had a house here in Park City before. There was organizations that represent the Muslim community. We have the LGBTQIA community that has a representation here. Sunrise House with these other groups, they also had a multicultural dinner that was a celebration of, you know, filmmaking from all of these groups that are typically under underrepresented. I did not get a ticket to that, so I was not able to be an observer to that, maybe next year. But it sounded like it was a real great celebration of these stories.
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear. Did you get to see any of the films this festival?
I did. I only got to see one. I was a little bit late. I was out of town when all of the tickets were being sold. But I saw a film. It was called The Stringer, which was made by a Vietnamese-American director. And it was a story about, you know, the 50th anniversary. It was a story about one of the iconic photos of the Vietnam War. Controversial, very interesting, a documentary. I love the documentaries that come out of Sundance because I always feel like it produces a different angle and really makes it's thought-provoking, as is all of the dramatic features as well. I also had the opportunity, and this again was an offshoot of Sundance, Naja Lockwood, who is an independent filmmaker here in Park City, local. She had a screening of her film that was down in Salt Lake City, and it's a film that's sponsored by Zions Bank and at Utah Film Center, and she had a screening, and she brought the Utah community, you know, together. I think there were over 200 people there to view her screening. So again, like, I feel like Sundance creates this environment for a lot of different conversations, and conversations that I think are very dear to Park City and what we represent. You know, this whole idea of these different houses that that are present during Sundance, I feel like is really core to who we are as Park City as well, because we believe in community, and we believe in community belonging, and that everybody has a voice.
Yeah, and I want to go back to the Park City piece of it in a couple of minutes, but first I also understand, well, Sundance provokes a lot of conversations about, you know, multicultural identities, voices that aren't traditionally mm-hmm. heard, but also themes that are becoming, you know, more popular and more talked about, like environmentalism and sustainability. And I understand you have some knowledge about some of the programming around that, too. It's could you tell us a little bit about Food Tank at this festival?
Yeah, I was really excited because Food Tank, which is a think tank around sustainable food systems, they were here with a whole day of programming to talk about food systems and climate and environment and how we can look at food in a different perspective. You know, how can we look at sustainable sourcing of food? How can we think about our food choices? They had a filmmaker there. They had people who are in the business and really advocating for sustainable food. And again, this is really tying into what we're doing at the Park City Community Foundation in terms of zero food waste and thinking about the downstream and the upstream effects of, you know, what we're trying to do with food collection. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that day of programming, I was only able to stay for a couple hours, but from what I've heard from friends is that there was a lot of takeaways because this is a national organization that's working on this, and here they were here in Park City, and there were tremendous takeaways that we can look at and think about within our own community.
Yeah. Oh, how cool that you were able to be part of those conversations.
I feel so lucky.
That's really cool. In terms of the Park City Community Foundation, you know, of course, Sundance is only here a couple weeks a year, but I'm sure takeaways from these kinds of programming you can bring back to the foundation. Do you have thoughts on how you'll bring this programming back for the rest of the year?
Oh, gosh. I mean, community belonging is one of the tenets of what we're trying to do at Park City Community Foundation. And Christine, who's the market, they don't even know that I'm here. You know, I'm a board member of the Community Foundation, and I hope I, you know, am speaking to this correctly. But community belonging, and you know about the Community Belonging Fund that's resulted out of this environment, that political environment that we're in right now. But that is one piece that we are going to continue to push forward. In fact, next week, as part of Leadership Park City and Leadership 101, there is going to be a session on community belonging that Diego Zagara, Joel Zaro, and myself were going to lead. And I think we just want to continue to push that everybody here in this community, every resident, every person who works here deserves to be seen, deserves to be heard, and deserves to feel like they contribute and add value to our community. And so what is the path and how are we going to get there? And that's something that we have to do as a community. In terms of environment and climate, we're going to continue to move forward on that. You know, again, we have ambitious goals for our zero food waste. We're looking at getting to zero food waste by 2030. And, you know, continue to kind of incubate and push great ideas that will help create a more sustainable environment here in Park City and beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. I'm glad that you were able to be part of these programs, the Sundance.
It was really wonderful. And I just, I feel like a lot of times what's out there is that there's a story about the films, and these films are incredible, and they really help to broaden our perspective. And that's really important for everybody who lives here in Park City. I really find that it brings the world, and it brings so many different diverse perspectives to our lives. And that's something that I find very valuable, and I hope everybody else in the community does too.
Absolutely. Well, E.E., anything else you want to add this morning?
Not much, except for I hope Sundance stays in Utah.
Yeah, I guess we'll know before too long.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
All right. Thank you so much, Grace.
We've been speaking with the Park City Community Foundation board member, E.E. Su. We'll be right back after this. Well, here in the studio with us, we've got Tracy Meyer. Tracy is the Chief Programming and Education Officer for the National Ability Center. Tracy, thanks for joining us. I understand you've got the Huntsman Cup coming up.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We're really excited to be hosting the 37th annual Huntsman Cup at our home resort of Park City Mountain. And with the support of the Epic Promise Grant, we'll be having 4 days of racing, a fist level race with a variety of athletes who are hoping to make the national team, training with the National Ability Center, and one day hope to become Paralympians.
It's very exciting. I guess, first of all, for people who might not be as familiar, could you share what events will be happening over those 4 days?
Yes, we will kick off on Monday the 3rd with a giant slalom event, another GS on Tuesday, followed by Wednesday and Thursday, two slalom races.
Okay, very nice. And tell us a little bit about, I mean, I understand these are para events. Could you tell us a little bit about the athletes who will be competing?
Sure. From a para perspective, there are really three different categories. There's a visually impaired category, a standing category, and sitting category. Athletes who are competing with disabilities received a classification based on their ability level, and then they have a factored system of what their timing is when they cross the finish line. So this is a race that helps them to gain points to, again, hopefully make the national team and be able to travel around the world and compete against everyone to get prepared for the next games.
Okay, very cool. And could you tell us a little bit about the size of the field? How many athletes are coming and where are they all from?
Yeah, we're looking at about 40 athletes, and excited to share that this is going to be the first time ever that we will be hosting not only a FIS sanctioned event, but also a Virtus sanctioned event. And what that is it's for elite athletes. We're partnering with Athletes Without Limits, and we will have 9 athletes here who are categorized in intellectual disabilities who compete at an elite level. They've had the opportunity to do this all over the world, but not in the U.S. This is the first time it's offered in the U.S. And so with that event, as well as our typical para event on the FIS side, we certainly have hometown athletes who are training here with the National Ability Center. And then we'll see athletes that are training out in Colorado, Seattle, Oregon. One of our athletes represents Puerto Rico. Canadian athletes will be joining. So it's going to be a really great field.
That's great. And I mean, yeah, so this is making history next month. Why is this such a big deal for you as part of the NAC to see this happen?
I think it's important for us to recognize that when someone has a disability, whether they're born or acquired with that, there are dreams and goals that come along with us, with, you know, being part of the recreation and the competitive world. And so at the National Ability Center, to have that pipeline, that opportunity for introduction to recreation, that you want to go out and ski and snowboard or ride horses or go river rafting for fun, or you have that drive that you want to represent your country and hope to be on top of that podium. So for us to be able to, one, be a place that people can train to pursue those goals and dreams. Two, to host an event here in the U.S. is something that we feel is deserved and should be part of the lives of people with disability.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And can members of the public watch the competition?
Yes, we would love that. If you haven't seen ski racing at this level, we would encourage you to come out. All of the races will be in the Eagle Race Arena at Park City. We are planning to start 10 o'clock is our first start time, and then second run at 12:30. We'd love for you to bring those cowbells and cheer on and gain some information and education about adaptive sports and competitive athletes. And come ask us questions. We'll have plenty of staff there. We'll be working with Toyota as well, so there'll be some great opportunities to learn about that partnership. And then after that, you could come and join us this weekend. On the 8th, we will be hosting our 40th celebration, 40 years of programming here in Park City. And so at our McGrath Mountain Center at the base from 3 to 5, we'll be having a celebration.
Okay, very cool. So that's 40 years of the NEC's presence here.
Yes.
Okay, awesome. And of course, you know, but beyond these elite level athletes, you have a lot of programming for younger athletes or more amateur levels of the sport. Could you talk a little bit about access to that?
Sure. With over 21 programs, we feel like we really have something for everyone. 30% of who we serve are those that have served our country and their family members. Another 30% are those that fall into that intellectual neurodiversity side of things, and then everything in between. So we really are a place for everyone. And that can be, again, that intro to recreation, building social skills, and helping us to break down barriers of showing that people with disabilities should be included in our community. So we have community-based events, as well as really fun adventure trips, mountain biking, you name it, right? What our beautiful state has to offer, we want to make sure that everyone has that opportunity. So about 60% of who we serve live here in Utah. 40% come and visit us from out of state. So in just a couple weeks, we'll be having a group from Chicago. It'll be close to 30 years that a group has been coming from a specific location in Chicago where they're serving individuals, young adults who have cancer or in remission. They're coming here for a ski week. So making sure that people know this is for everyone. They can give us a call, check out our website, discovernac.org, and knowing that scholarships are available. So we're really trying to do our best to remove those barriers so that people can receive the true benefits of recreation.
Yeah, and just going back to the Huntsman Cup for a minute, I can imagine that it could make a difference for, you know, a kid growing up or somebody who's recovering from some sort of disabling event to be able to know that there's this inclusion and representation in sport. Could you speak at all to that?
Yeah, I think, can you imagine, you know, not being able to see role models? So you see someone that is a wheelchair user, maybe a mono skier, and you see them up ripping on this course, traveling around the world. Like, what a great vision for someone that, you know, that's what they want to pursue. So to be able to come and see that, whether it's here at Huntsman Cup or through our other programs, we certainly hope that we are continuing to build the world of inclusion and the world of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And could you tell us the dates one more time of
sure.
that cup?
Yeah, February 3rd through 6th. So next Monday through Thursday at the base of our home resort of Park City.
Awesome. And can people go online to find more information about what the events are?
Yes, you can go to our website, discovernac.org. You'll see information about the Huntsman Cup and all of the other programs and volunteer opportunities that we have.
Awesome. Great to hear. Well, anything else people should be aware of coming up for the NAC?
Well, we mentioned that 40th celebration on the 8th, so we'd love to see you then, as well as we're really excited for Red, White, and Snow, the beginning of March, which is one of our most esteemed fundraising events for us to continue to say yes to our participants so we can continue to have that scholarship fund. But I got to tell you, we always have something great going on, so encourage you to go to our website or give us a call, and there's different ways for everyone to be involved.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for all those details, Tracy.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in this morning.
Yeah.
We've been speaking with the National Ability Center's Tracy Meyer. We will be back with more local news after this. Summit County has the most short-term rentals in Utah, and it may get more power to regulate them. KPCW's Connor Thomas has details on House Bill 256.
The Kim C. Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah estimates there were more than 6,400 short-term rentals in Summit County in 2023. And according to Councilmember Chris Robinson, only about 1,200 of those have the required business license.
And our hands have been tied with the tools that we could otherwise use to track down those that are not in compliance.
House Bill 256, Municipal Zoning Amendments, gives counties and cities a more powerful tool. It lets them use online listings on sites like Airbnb and VRBO as evidence that a short-term rental took place. Then code enforcement officers could issue a violation, providing they had, quote, additional information supporting their decision. Deputy Summit County Manager Jana Young.
We are seeking clarification on what that supporting information is, because currently we're allowed to use guest reviews or statements as evidence that they rented it as part of our enforcement efforts. And so we'd like to be able to maintain that in the new legislation.
HB 256 is sponsored by St. George Republican Representative Neil Walter, and it needs approval from the House Political Subdivisions Committee before it goes to the whole House. If passed, Summit County staff believe it would be easier to collect the transient room tax that, in theory, all hotels and rentals must pay. It's a major source of revenue for Summit County and its cities that funds tourism, recreation, cultural, convention, or airport facilities. Summit County Manager Shane Scott says it would be a way to contact rental owners in the event of a disaster, too.
If we could get every short-term rental in the county with a business license, we'd at least know who's here, who's coming.
The county's focusing on licensing until it's ready to release more comprehensive regulations. 2 years ago, council members considered a moratorium on issuing short-term rental licenses. Critics say STRs contribute to housing unavailability and unaffordability for workers and would-be full-time residents. Following pushback from real estate and lodging industry organizations, the council backed off a ban. Council members still resolved to do something. A subcommittee is drafting the regulations.
There have been a lot of committee meetings. One of the consistent issues is trying to understand what is the problem we're trying to solve. And there's not a lot of consensus on that.
That's County Clerk Eve First back in November of 2024. Last August, local and regional realtors lobbied the Summit County and Park City Councils in a joint meeting not to ban short-term rentals outright. They say similar measures in mountain towns brought down property values. County Council members Tanya Hansen and Roger Armstrong got the short-term rental subcommittee appointments this year. Freshman council member Megan McKenna, who spoke favorably about the moratorium 2 years back, didn't, but she may vote on any ordinance the subcommittee comes up with. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And some Utah lawmakers are pushing back on budget cuts for public universities, citing concern the funding loss will reduce or eliminate liberal arts programs. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
The Salt Lake Tribune reports one Republican senator questioned what the point of traditional education was. Senator John Johnson from North Ogden, an emeritus professor at the University of Utah, said a degree should be about more than just job preparation. He said university students should be learning how to be critical thinkers, be flexible, and develop as leaders, all skills taught in humanities and social science courses. Others on the 17-member Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee, including other Republicans, agreed. Republican Senator Evan Vickers said every student benefits from liberal arts classes. The Cedar City pharmacist said he doesn't hire people who only know the science of his profession. He wants employees who can think, adjust, and, quote, take the profession to the next level. The conversation follows a push by legislative leaders to cut $60 million from the state's 8 traditional public colleges and universities. That money would be set aside for strategic reinvestment. Faculty in Utah are afraid the liberal arts will be first in line for cuts without considering other harder-to-quantify arts benefits. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
On the phone with me now, we have Ron Jackenthal. He's from the Live Like Sam Foundation, and he's got some more information about the Thrive program that the foundation does. Ron, good morning. How are you?
Good, Grace. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for joining us this morning. So I understand Thrive is all about youth mental health. Could you, I guess, just first give us an introduction to the program?
Sure. So we partnered with an organization, We Be Well, out of the University of Utah 3 years ago. And the goal was to create a mental health and well-being program for teens. And so we worked with them to adapt an adult program that they had that really focuses on youth well-being, prevention, healthy habits. And it's been a really incredible program. We have research being done at the University of Utah. We're seeing results for kids with like anxiety going down 25%. Reduction by 21%. And essentially, it's a 6-week program where students meet in a cohort of kids of similar age, and they're led via Zoom by two adult facilitators through 6 different lessons. It's an hour lesson each week. It's a $500 program that we fully scholarship, and the students that graduate get a $60 research stipend.
Okay, very nice. And what age group is this program for?
Yeah, great question. So it is for middle schoolers, so really ages 11 on up, middle schoolers and high schoolers.
Okay, very nice. And does it take place in person? Is it virtual? What's that look like?
Yeah, most of the cohorts are done virtually, and it's just worked out really well. We launched in COVID, and just, you know, our kids are so busy, right? They're so overscheduled with sports and other extracurricular activities that we found it generally works best for most of the kids to do it after school and do it from home once they've gotten home, had a snack, get settled in. However, we do work with some schools like Wileman and the Winter Sports School, where we have gone in and done in-person programming.
Okay, gotcha. And who administers the program? I mean, if it's through the foundation, but who are the people working directly with the students?
Yeah, so we kind of split responsibilities. So Live Like Sam is really responsible for the overall leadership and recruitment of students and interaction with parents and all the partners in the community. So we really work closely with families, health workers, and educators and other nonprofits to find students, especially those that might have higher needs. And then our partner, WeBeWell, it's their curriculum, and they facilitate the programming. And then together they help us get the independent research that's being done out of the University of Utah to measure the impact of the program.
Okay, very nice. You mentioned that there are some scholarships available for kids who want to take part. How can people take part in that? How can they apply?
Yeah, so really the good news is for now, so over the last 2.5 years, we've put over 1,200 kids through this 6-week program. This program costs us over $500 per student. And through the generosity of the community, whether it be donations, attending our events, or grants, we've been able to fully scholarship 100% of the students. And with that, also provide a research stipend. So right now, we have probably another 50 spots open for our first session of 2025. Registration for that session closes next Thursday, February 6th at midnight. They can go to our website, livelikesam.org. You'll see it, a way to access Thrive, or you can go to programs and then go to Thrive and register. And then the program starts, the 6-week program starts on February 10th, and I think there's about 15 different options, so it could be, you know, Mondays from 4 to 5 or 5 to 6, and then it kind of repeats itself throughout the week, so they can choose the day of week and time of day that works best for their schedule.
Okay, just based on, you know, all those extra other extracurriculars that students all have on their plates.
This is a busy community.
That's for sure. What geographic area are you serving? Is it the whole Wasatch Back?
Yeah, so the program is really meant for students who live or go to school in Summit County or Wasatch County. And it's really interesting. Like, we really launched in Wasatch about a year ago, and it was somewhat of a soft launch. And we're seeing at least a third of the students come from, you know, Wasatch County or the eastern side of Summit County. And we're really proud of that distribution. And maybe a few other things just to mention. So Thrive, you know, is 6 topics, just to give you some sense. Like, a few of my favorites are, like, exploring character strengths. Another one is, like, stress management techniques for reducing thinking traps. So, like, as humans, as kids, and quite frankly, even as adults, like, we get stuck in these thought traps and we ruminate. And so this is a good example of where we work with the kids to teach them how to identify when they're maybe in, like, a negative thought pattern and how to kind of hold space for it and capture it and analyze it, and then give them techniques to get through that and realize that maybe they're getting caught up in the moment, they're super stressed, but when they really look at it pragmatically, it's not such a big deal. So really it's about giving them tools for different situations and to create healthy habits where possible.
And hopefully those are, you know, tools that they'll be able to use the rest of their lives. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, for listeners who might not be as familiar with the Live Like Sam Foundation, how does this program fit in with your larger work as an organization?
Sure. So this is a legacy foundation. 9 years ago, we've lived here for over almost 25 years, my family. And 9 years ago, my oldest child, my son Sam, was a U.S. ski champ. He had an unfortunate ski accident in Australia, and Sam ultimately passed away. And from that, this community really rallied around our family. And for the first 4 or 5 years, we tried to figure out, like, how do we honor Sam, but also really make an impact in the community? And it wasn't really obvious, right? Like, parents or fathers against U.S. ski champions is different than mothers against drunk driving. There wasn't something that was crystal clear that we could go out and make a difference. And through a lot of research and exploration, we realized there was a huge gap, not only in this community around the country, but especially here. There's just a huge gap in a lack of programming for youth well-being and prevention through positive programming and teaching kids life skills. And so that's our lane. That's where we decided to go. And last year we impacted over 4,000 local youth from grades K through 12 with different programming. Our heaviest and most impactful evidence-based programming is Thrive, but we do programming for elementary school children, in school, out of school, middle school children, and high school students as well. And then we've had such great success with Thrive. The state of Utah gave us evidence-based certification last year. Thrive is also part of the Summit County Strategic Health Plan, and we are about to launch Thrive 2.0, so it's the next progression in Thrive programming. Some of the topics there will be like contributing to the happiness of others, which is a really important skill to learn. Another one is handling conflicts effectively, right? Like setting boundaries and dealing with conflicts. It's just something that we all have to deal with. And, you know, look, since COVID, the state of mental health for our youth has really plummeted across the board. I mean, right now, and these are some pretty staggering stats from the Sharp survey, which we do every 2 years here in Summit County, but 76% of our students experience significant depressive symptoms, and 53% of them have mental health treatment needs. And that's staggering. I mean, half our kids have the need for mental health treatment. And so this is our way of proactively giving kids access to programming. And hopefully the goal is that they'll develop more self-love, more self-compassion. And, you know, if you love something, you're just much less apt to hurt it, and you're much more apt to want to take care of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for people who are listening and this resonates for them, could you share one more time where they can find more information, where they can apply ahead of that deadline next week?
Yeah, so two things. You can go to our website, livelikesam.org, and then just look up programming, and you'll see Thrive, and they can register for Thrive. And like I said, we cover the cost of the programming for their students. There's also a place where you can enter information to get notified about another program we're piloting next month, and that's digital wellness. And it's really about the harms of social media. And, I mean, look, most of our teenagers are spending 4 to 5 hours a day on social media. And so we have developed a program with another partner that we're beta-ing or piloting in April. That's really going to teach kids healthy habits around social media and help them, realize these things, like some of the images they're seeing are filters and they're not, or there's like, you know, they have fear of missing out or there's fake news. So we're really going to try to help the kids have a healthier relationship with their tech.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing more about the Thrive program this morning, Ron.
Grace, really great to talk to you again, and thanks again for all your support.
Thanks. Anything else you want to add this morning?
Hopefully we get a lot of snow this weekend and everyone gets to have a couple of powder days.
It does look like there's some snow in the forecast, so hopefully so. Thanks again, Ron. We've been speaking with Ron Jackenthal of the Live Like Sam Foundation. We have got KPCW's own John Burdick and Sarah Irvin in the studio with us. They're here to talk about the community campfire, which is new to the radio. Well, John and Sarah, first of all, what is the community campfire?
Yes, that is a great question.
Great question, Grace. Thanks for having us.
Yep. So we are going to introduce a new community campfire show on Fridays. It's 9 a.m. on Fridays, kind of like our other public affairs shows. We have Mountain Money on Mondays, Tuesdays, This Green Earth, Wednesdays, The Mountain Life, and then Thursdays, Cool Science Radio. So we used to do a show in this hour time slot when we first introduced the public affairs shows. It started with Fun Friday, which I was a host of. This is back in 2010. And then we moved that into the morning mix with Christy Dillaway and John Wells as the hosts. I was hosting with Jan Williams, who was the old program director. And so we have decided to bring back a community-oriented show, a fun show called The Community Campfire, tying back to our roots. If you've been listening to KPCW for, say, 40-plus years, you would know the term The Community Campfire that was introduced way back when Blair and started the station.
Yeah, we're really excited about this because it gives us an opportunity to do, you know, deeper dive storytelling on the people who make up the Wasatch Back, you know, the fun stories that might not make daily news, might not be breaking news, but really deserve that sort of more human interest storytelling side of things. So think about like NPR's StoryCorps or The Moth, programs like that. That's really what we're hoping to emulate and bring some, you know, uplifting, fun vibes yep. to Friday mornings and feature a lot of just local voices of all ages. We'll have kids on there.
Yeah, so we put together this idea of campfire kids. And again, this is an engagement for our listening audience, and we really want to get feedback through this show. And if there's people in town that you really think our core people that we need to get into talking to in a deeper level, we're going to have the campfire at kpcw.org is a place to start, or you can always send us an email at either Sarah or John, and we will get going on that. But with the campfire kids idea is they do say the darndest things, and people might remember that show. And we just thought there are so many great voices of our community that we want to get involved with this show. And also to add on that StoryCorps, there's the idea with NPR programming, there's a show called The Tiny Desk. And when Craig Elliott designed this studio, we were designed to have live bands in the studio. And then COVID hit, and then we didn't let anybody in the studio. So we want to try to utilize what was a brilliant design for where we broadcast from and feature local artists. Again, this really is a show that is going to bring our community together like a campfire, like sitting around mm-hmm, a campfire.
A crackling campfire. It's funny that you mentioned, you know, Craig Elliott helped design this building. Emily Elliott was a voice for the Friday morning shows, too, for the longest time, and a longtime member
Friday
of
DJ.
The... member of the KPCW family, and now we have Mitch Elliott working on our team here, who's sure. going to help produce those live music moments that you'll hear on the community campfire. So we might need to actually do a deep dive on the Elliott family, I think, as one
I
of
think,
our...
I think there's no question that their contribution will get three generations,
yeah,
you know, two
exactly.
generations there. The other thing there that you bring up Emily's show on Fridays, anybody that listened to her show, she had a segment that she would always do right before she signed off where she would do her football picks of the week. And so inspired by getting some sports on, we have Coach Skinner and the Skinny on Sports, where we'll be talking with athletes throughout our entire high school community, and not just football, but all sports throughout the season. And if we can, we'll try to feature some of the local talent that we have within the sports realm with our very own Bill Skinner jumping in the studio with Sarah and I, who will be hosting this. And then they'll be fun. They'll be feel good. We're just trying to get a good vibe going on Fridays. Sometimes the news is a little depressing, as you might know, Grace. And so we want to just uplift people on a Friday night with the community campfire.
Awesome. Well, I know you guys have already been out and about gathering material for this new show.
Yep.
What's been the highlight so far?
Well, I had a chance to go to a Learn to Curl class at the Park City Ice Arena on a Monday night a couple weeks ago with Amber Johnson, our community engagement manager. We had a blast, and the curling community is strong here. Yeah. That was a fun one. And then yesterday
we got to go on the bobsled at the UOP. Nice. And again, the UOP does do some sponsorship here on the station. We got to get out, and we got our cool running bobsled team together. Sarah and I and Bill got in this bobsled, and we were able to get down the track in 46.25 seconds.
I think it was a new world record.
I think it was a record definitely for KPCW bobsled teams.
But that's the kind of thing that, you know, we're looking for some of these experience stories, things that we never thought we'd do and that people around town might do all the time, but we want to hear their stories. So if you've got ideas for the community campfire, please reach out to us. You can connect with us on the new and improved KPCW app under that Let's Connect button.
Oh, yeah, just you can record also, your story.
Yeah, you can tell us what you want us to feature. You can also reach out, like John said, over email, communitycampfire@kpcw.org. And we look forward to everyone tuning in. The show will air, important details.
Yes.
The show will debut next Friday, February 7th, right here on KPCW at 9 a.m. And every Friday thereafter, 9 a.m.'s
on Friday. Tune in.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much. This is Local News Hour.